The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Now, just one more question is the title of a book, Stories from a Knife in Neurology, and it's been written by Professor Neil Tobridy. What exactly is neurology? What is a neurologist?
It's a strange breed of doctors, I think. Well, certainly we're seen as a strange breed of doctors
who
study the brain. And because you can't see the brain normally, a lot of it is based on listening to patients' stories, as per the book, and also the examination. So it's a very kind of an old-fashioned, I think, branch of medicine or edge of medicine, which has become more
But you can do CAT scans, can't you? You can do scans of the brain. What do you see in those?
You can do CAT scans, and that would be like a black and white photograph. And now we have MRI scans, which are like high-definition Sky Sports. So we've got even better scans. And then we've got scans called PET scans and all sorts of scans, which take beautiful photographs of the landscape of what makes us human.
Yeah, what can you tell from that? Because presumably science and doctors have known for many generations about the makeup of a brain by taking brains from dead people. But trying to examine live people without cutting them open to have a look, what can you tell from all these various scans and MRIs and the rest of it?
Well, you can tell almost everything, almost everything. What we do is, someone like me will do anyway, we'll take a story from a person, then we'll examine them and we'll say, right, we want to take a picture, not of the whole landscape, we want to take a picture of the left side of that part of the brain so that we can focus the scan straight in there. And we'll know from the demographics of someone, say a young white female with a weak leg, we'll say, oh, we're looking for MS, for example, or we're looking for, if it's a smoker, we might be looking for a brain tumour. If it's an older person, we might do specific nuclear scans for someone with Parkinson's, for example. So it's led by the person rather than putting someone in a scanner and saying, read the scan ab initio, just from the off the cuff.
And you can see those things, can you? Because I can imagine that, yes, you can see a tumour. I think a lot of people hear in fear about brain tumours, for example, but that they perceive that to be a lump on the brain of some kind. But other things such as Parkinson's, those other diseases you mentioned, what do you actually see in the brain that tells you?
Well, the best way to describe it would be, say, MS, multiple sclerosis. So multiple sclerosis, as the name implies, is multiple little white spots you see all over the brain in specific areas. So there's little lakes in the middle of the brain called ventricles. And if the white spots are around the shore of the lake, that'll say that might be MS. So the distribution and size and number of the white spots will, in the right context, say that look, context, sorry, will suggest that's MS. For Parkinson's, it's a different scan altogether called, would you believe, a DAT, D-A-T, dopamine transport scan, which you ingest a bit of iodine and then it lights up in the right area when you don't have Parkinson's. And when you do have Parkinson's, it's like a dimmer switch on it and you see much less in one area compared to the other. So it's pretty, they're complementary to what I do, I hope. So otherwise the scans would take over and I'd be useless.
Yeah, and how long are you actually practicing this area of medicine?
Well, I qualified in 1991 and then you train for more years now than I can actually remember. But I would have been doing this since I was about 26, 7 years of age, I'd be a neurologist. And so you're talking over 20 years.
Okay, and how much has it changed even in that time? How much has medicine and science advanced with technology, for example, to let you know so much more about a person's brain?
It's changed massively and all for the better. So it's great because I've told people that a lot of my senior mentors when I was a student said, when I expressed an interest in neurology, they said, why would you bother? You will be replaced by MRIs and everything else. And they had a point, but not really. So because now the scans and everything take away the humanity of all this. And it's still an art as well as a science doing medicine. So all of these things have changed in my lifetime. Unbelievably changed. When I started for MS, for example, which is kind of my specialist area, and hence I go on about it a little, that we would give people evening primrose oil, which was less than useless. But we had nothing else. Whereas now there are three shelves of treatment that we can go to when we're giving hope and optimism and treatment for people.
You actually just preempted the question I was about to ask you, because it has struck me that how much of your work is involved in diagnosis, but then not being able to do anything really to prevent the development of an illness or to stop death.
Quite a lot is involved. So diagnosis, and it used to be said of neurologists that they'd make a diagnosis and apologise. But now treatments have come in, and we have layers and layers of treatments to discuss in MS, in epilepsy, in Parkinson's, in migraine. You know, there's a huge amount we can do. But of course, there are still areas of the brain we know nothing about or feel we know nothing about. And we are indeed fairly useless in that area. So we're not under any delusions of grandeur, but there's been huge progress made in my little career so far.
What got you into this?
Curiosity, I think. I was always curious person, curious about things rather than being curious myself. And I think as I went through medicine, I found a couple of senior doctors who were teaching me at the time just seemed to get a patient's diagnosis and the history and a much more, dare I say, cool level, but certainly it just on an existential level. I just liked the idea of studying the brain. And then I saw a couple of cases that I thought, well, wow, that is just, well, to my young mind, blew my mind.
And what sort of cases?
I think the first one that I really got into was when I saw a case of transient global amnesia. And as the
What's that called
again? I know, as the name implies, it's transient, doesn't last long. It's global, it's all over the place. And amnesia is memory. So it's a loss of memory, of all of your memory, for a short period of time. And when I first saw that with a senior colleague, I really couldn't believe it. And I don't mean to be too excitable these days, but I was then. And in essence, what had happened was and it's mentioned in the book that one of the patients had jumped into the sea or had gone for a swim or a shower, and this I've seen hundreds of times. And then they hop out and they lose all memory for about anything between 1 hour and 12, 14 hours or longer.
Why?
We think it's due to a spasm of the blood vessels to the memory centres, but we don't frankly know. So in other words, we think that there's a loss of blood flow to the memory centres transiently. So it's like a stroke, but not quite.
I was just about to ask if it was a stroke, yes.
No, initially it was thought to be a stroke or even an epileptic fit or even a migraine. But the fact of the matter is, and this is what other people might see as frustrating, I see as fantastically interesting, is why does it happen? And sometimes we just don't know.
And you've seen that hundreds of times?
Hundreds, yeah. It's amazing. I've seen... especially where I work at the moment around Vincent's, there's cold water, the sea all around there. So people hop into the water in Sea Point and they come out and can't remember where their cars are or where their clothes are. So then I see them in Vincent's casualty and they'll be still asking repetitive questions. So
and are there long-term effects from that?
No. They seem to recover after about 5 or 6 hours and they might remember little bits of it. They might regain some of that lost time, but never all of it. And it rarely recurs. And why it happens... we just don't know, but I found this absolutely mind-blowing in every sense, quite frankly, when I was a young doctor. And I said, wow, that's extraordinary. I want to look into that more.
Why neurology rather than psychiatry?
Because I liked the aesthetic, dare I say, of the neurological exam. I love the practice of, it's a very long playing record type of examination where you're examining everything going from your left brain to your right foot, from your right brain to your left foot, and then back up again. So you're following train tracks back and forth from your brain and trying to see where they're derailed. And if you can find that out, then take a picture of it and see why it's derailed.
Does that mean for a lot of people that their behaviour is almost beyond them, that it just happens because they can't control what's going on in their brain?
No, I don't think so. I think what happens is... it's not really a behavioural thing, it's a structural thing. So if I have a stroke right now, you know, I lose the power on one side of my arm, one side of my body, my right arm and leg, for example. And that will mean that on the left side of my brain there's been a loss of blood flow, a blocked drain, if you like. And then we try and unblock it.
So do you deal with strokes as well very much in
your
work?
Yes, particularly young people with strokes. So most of my colleagues would be looking after stroke would be the care of the elderly physicians, and then we deal with the under 65s.
But I think with some of the other things I was mentioning, or what I was trying to hint at, was that could there be times when somebody is acting in an odd way, their behaviour is not in character, but it's not something that they necessarily have control about. It's just something that's going on in the brain, which they just can't control.
Oh, unquestionably. You remember the book, or you've heard of the book and the Netflix movie now called Brain on Fire?
Yes, I interviewed the author of the book.
Did
yes,
you?
Yes.
Oh, amazing. Well, we see similar cases all the time where your immune system, the person's immune system goes off kilter and then it starts looking for work and so it starts attacking various centres of the brain. So you're absolutely right that suddenly the whole behaviour can change, and so we'll do a brain scan, should see areas of relevance or changes in the texture of the brain, if you like. And then we'll do a spinal tap, a lumbar puncture, which is like testing the chlorine of a swimming pool in which the nerves are swimming. So you test it and say, well, can you find these bad antibodies? And then if they've got bad antibodies, we send in an army of good antibodies.
And that's what I was just getting to as well. It's just the army of treatments available to you now. Tell me about how they've progressed.
Well, I mentioned the shelves of MS treatments that have gone from evening primrose oil to at least 3 shelves of treatments, which are amazing. For things like that, the brain on fire type scenario, there are legion numbers of antibodies we now have discovered, famous scientist type people, not myself, have discovered, and we've learned from them. And so when we find a bad antibody, we now treat with good antibodies. So that wasn't there when I started. It's called immunoglobulin. And it wasn't there when I started. Then there's old treatments where you've got inflammation, like you would get arthritis in a joint. You can get inflammation in the brain. So we'd use steroids and things like that. So, yeah, there's quite a bit we can do.
Okay, in the time I've left with you, Professor Neil Tubridy, author of Just One More Question, I have a few more questions to finish off with. Very basic, simple question, though, because you've mentioned the left side of the brain, the right side of the brain a number of times. What's the difference?
Well, I'm right-handed. Are you right-handed?
Yes.
Yeah, so we're both right-handed. That means that our left hemispheres of our brain are dominant, which means that our speech is in our left side of our brain. So if either of us, unfortunately, have a stroke right now, on the left side of my brain, the conversation ends right now. If it's on the right side, my speech should continue. It won't be as eloquent as I hope it to be, but my speech will be preserved.
Okay. Can people equalize between the left and the right? For example, you talk about sports stars who are able to kick off either foot, or who are hurlers who might be able to use the grip on either side, either arm. And can you train yourself to use your brain equally, left and right side?
Oh, definitely you can, because as you know from friends or parents or grandparents, that a lot of left-handers when they were younger were told that they had to tie that hand behind their back by the various powers that be and write with the right hand. So these people were originally left-handed, but the right side of their brain would be dominant. So of course you can train one way or the other, but your speech in both of us right-handers will still almost certainly be in our left hemisphere.
So I've heard it said previously as well that about 90% of your brain does not get used. Is that true?
I don't think so, no. I don't think I would really, even though it's a job I've been doing for 25 years, understand the evidence for that, because how would we know what we're not using?
Can you overuse your brain in that it becomes overwhelming if your brain is worrying, trying to do too many things?
I think most of us do at some point, and we call it clutter. But basically, I think we overuse it with being on our phones all the time, and certainly I have periods of overthinking, not out of intelligence, just out of worry and anxiety like the rest of the world. So yes, I think we can overuse it into a point of where we can't sleep, then we become anxious. And if we're worried about medical conditions, particularly in relation to the brain, so if I forget my keys this morning, I forget where they are, then I might, as the day goes on, say, gosh, I hope I don't have dementia. And then I worry myself into dementia. Not quite, but into worrying about dementia.
And just a final thing, food for the brain. What is food for the brain? Is it reading? Or is it actual physical food?
It's definitely not just reading. I think it's stimulus in general. So I would consider that social stimulus, going out, having fun, not drinking too much, but having fun, listening to music, that kind of thing, rather than any sort of necessarily proven foods like probiotics or anything like that.
So you don't believe in this thing that you actually can use physical food that will actually enhance or improve your brain?
I know there's a huge amount of work going on at the moment, so I wouldn't dismiss that idea completely, but I wouldn't feel comfortable saying that take this food and your brain will get better. I'd say read a book and go out and have a good laugh with friends.
Okay, just one more question.
Beautiful.
Would you actually recommend things like, people say as they get older, to keep the brain active, to do things like do your crosswords or Sudoku, or learning a new language, or taking on something new that you have to learn to really stimulate a brain which might, as you get older, start slowing down?
I think it just makes common sense, and you don't need a neurologist to tell you that the more you use it, the less you're likely to lose it. But at the same token, I think the converse is also true. If you find yourself isolated in any time of your life, that maybe your thought processes might have a tendency to slow. So common sense would say, so long as you're stimulating the brain in some way, you're less likely to lose it.
Okay. What prompted you to write the book?
I was thinking at the age I am in life that I really love telling the stories about all the people I see, and they're all conflations of people. No one is identifiable. But what I really thought was, gosh, this is a fascinating little life I'm led and I'm leading. And then I was speaking to friends and they said, stop talking about it and get on with it. So I listened to them.
Some of the teasers are incredible. The painter who believes her left hand is her guardian angel. The old man who sees Santa Claus in a helicopter in his bedroom. The man who's been hiccuping for nearly 30 years. What's that got to do with?
Well, you hiccup sometimes when you drink water too quickly or anything like that, or food goes down, or hot Indian food or something. But sometimes you can have a stroke in that part of the brain. So if you think about it, there has to be a hiccuping center somewhere in your brain. There has to be a breathing center, heartbeat center. Everything begins and ends in the brain as far as I'm concerned. But then I would say that, wouldn't I?
Just one more question is Neil Tubridy's book, Stories from a Life in Neurology. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.